So we'll begin the evening session with some questions, maybe some answers. There's actually only one question, so. This one is, my activist neighbor is going to Nevada to register voters. It's difficult to convince myself that I'm sitting for the benefit of all beings, not just giving myself a, quote, gift, unquote, let alone explaining a week of sitting to her. Can you comment? So, I mean, there's a couple different layers there. One is the main one, I think, that leaps out is one doesn't. I don't think one needs to be explaining oneself to everybody. especially in the light of loving kindness. In that one, it's usually not an act of loving kindness to try to compare yourself to others and then explain yourself to others. That's usually an exercise in judgment towards oneself, which you almost invariably come up short. I mean, the very act of or the very impulse to have to explain oneself to others is almost invariably generated from a sense of, you know, I must be doing something wrong, therefore I have to explain myself. So you're inevitably going to come up short and that's a good question. Is this an act of kindness towards myself? And then, of course, is it an actual act of kindness to explain yourself to other people? Do they actually need to know? the American compulsion to explain yourself to others. And it's like, I remember the very first year that I came to America to help Rabbi Geary, and then was invited on alms round to Peter Malin's house, which is about 7 miles from the monastery. So you walk down Tomkai Road and down East Road to get to their house. And walking an alms round to get there, and it's a long walk, and then this woman happened to pull over and say, "Oh, where are you going? Do you need a ride?" And you're very kind, and we had kind of misjudged the time, so we were running a bit late, so it was quite good to have a bit of a ride. But it wasn't that far. It was still maybe a mile or a mile and a half left. So it wasn't that far. In the distance of a mile or a mile and a half, I knew more about this woman's life than I didn't really want to know. So, I had never seen her before. So then, you know, there is a compulsion in the American psyche to try to explain everything to everybody. And, I don't know how much of a kindness that is to other people. So those are some kind of basic sort of thoughts as well, you know, in terms of that reflection of around loving kindness. And, you know, is it a kindness to oneself? Is it a kindness to others? The whole realm of you know, the meditation and activism, sort of, well, you know, what's better, and what should I be doing? You know, I think there's a tendency in the mind to think in terms of either or. And, you know, either I should be doing this, or I should be doing either this is right and that's wrong, or either that's wrong and this is right. That's actually very divisive and complicates things. And again, is that a kindness to think in that way? This is real questioning of the underlying ways that we relate to ourselves, the world around us, how we relate to others, and that framework of right and wrong, either or. I think it's really important in terms of practice, and particularly from this perspective of loving kindness, to get some space around that whole way of thinking and dividing things up and separating them out and being in opposition to things. I think it's quite a helpful way to reflect on things in terms of because how the Buddha structured things was not so much in, you know, right and wrong, but it's more like skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. And you realize, well, you know, somebody who is registering voters and activists involved in that, you know, that's wholesome, that's skillful, that's a good thing to do. And is it what I need to be doing, or what I want to be doing right now, or do I want to, do I feel drawn to that? Maybe yes, maybe no, but being able to sort of see somebody else's skillfulness or their wholesome activity, and being able to delight in that, or to have a sense of encouragement, and without it intimidating oneself. And that, you know, other people can do that, or if they're happy to do that, they're sort of, oh, that's great. But then, oh, well, what I'd like to do for this week is, at least, is to be having a chance to have a period of retreat, you know, settling, creating an inner anchor for oneself. And, you know, that's a wholesome thing, that's a good thing, that's a skillful thing. And it doesn't mean because one has made the choice to be in retreat, of course, I'm right, and yeah, the rest of those smugs out there, I mean, they really blew the shot. it's sort of the sense of, yeah, these are very separate sort of realms, and one can encourage oneself in the choices that one makes without undermining oneself, and that's an act of kindness. One can also see how other people choose to put their time and energy, and to encourage them, to support them, or to at least sort of delight in the good that they're doing. And then that's one's own, that is one's own wholesomeness as well. I mean, one benefits from that. There's a there's a word in Buddhist jargon called in Pali, it's called punya, and in the Thai language it's bun, and inevitably if Thai people living in maybe they've been to the West, or they meet a Westerner who's studying Buddhism, and one of the things they'll always ask, how do you translate bun? It's like, it's one of these impossible, very difficult terms to translate. But the word and concept of punya is, the Buddha himself said, punya is another word for happiness. And what it is the results of skillful action, the good, wholesome action, activity, qualities that result in happiness and well-being for oneself and for others. So that generosity and giving is punya. Keeping precepts and having virtues is punya. Meditation is punya. Listening to teachings is punya. Teachings is punya. Giving the opportunity for other people to access teachings is punya. Helping others, service, acts of service are punya. The delighting in the good that other people do is punya. Dedicating the blessings that come from one's own good action is punya. And there's many, many levels, and this, but these are avenues of creating happiness. And one realizes that again, tying into the theme of loving kindness, these are acts of loving kindness. There's a sense that recognition of that which is wholesome and skillful, and then the commitment to doing that, going ahead, and then realizing that it's not fixed. Okay, if I'm not meditating, I'm wasting my time, sort of, or there. So that there's many, many avenues of wholesome and skillful action. So that those, and to be able to have that recognition of the spectrum, so one can seize the opportunity. It's like seeing somebody else doing something skillful, and then delighting in that, sort of, that the word anumodana is to say delighting in the good that is done. But it's a you don't even have to do anything. You see somebody else doing something, rather than sort of either it being intimidating, oh God, I don't measure up, or being jealous, they're not so good, really. I mean, they're just, it's like, they're that kind of, there's a sort of criticism or a way to sort of pull them down a bit, put them in their place. You know, it's very, very small-minded. It's not kind to oneself. It's not kind to others. Whereas those sense of there's a spaciousness in the heart that is one is not intimidated. By others, or is not torturing oneself because one's not doing quite the right thing, or one's not doing it in the right way. There's feeling guilty about something that one didn't do properly, and sort of caring. It goes on and on, and. None of that is a kindness to oneself or to others. I remember one time traveling as a translator and attendant to a very senior Thai monk, very well known, very highly respected. Lopa Panyananda, who a few in the room have. We went to, I took a group to Thailand. We went to pay respects to him. And, there's somebody with serious punya. just this a whole life of giving. And when we went, he was sick and he was in a hospital, but it was a hospital that he built for people, so that he wasn't that sick. So they just wanted him in the hospital so they could look after him. because he was about 96 at the time or something, but very bright. But I traveled with him. It was in the 1980s, and we were in New Zealand. And it was an evening session, chanting, meditation, Dhamma talk, questions after. And then one of the questions that somebody asked fairly early on was, how do we deal with guilt? How do you, sort of that feeling of guilt? And of course, being I was familiar with that feeling, but the interesting thing was when I went to translate it, I realized I don't know what the word for guilt is in Thai. I've been translating for teachers and studying the language and the Dhamma, and I just sort of burst out laughing. And then explained to him what the question was, why I was laughing. He says, the idea that the concept was a bit distant in the language, in the culture. So what I had to do was then explain to him what a Westerner does to make themselves feel guilty. And he listened, and he's got this very concerned look on his face as I'm explaining how guilt works. And he listened, and I finished the explanation. He said, That's really suffering. It tells them not to do that. and it isn't as if Thai people don't have these emotions for them, but it's, I think it, there's a very healthy place for remorse, but that complication of guilt that that's so easy to carry around because of this very strong sense of self. me, and judgment. Those are, that judging, comparing, dividing oneself into me in this world that I'm trying to either live up to or being intimidated by. Those are distinctions that are, they're very painful. And so that the, say, an act of loving kindness is one of saying, well, this is the way things are, in the sense of, there is a feeling. I said, well, that's just a feeling. Can I get some space around that? Can I not contend with that? Can I slip into those feelings of comparison and suffering that are attendant on that? So that's an act of loving kindness towards oneself. So these elements of seeing somebody who is doing something good, and then being able to not make that a judgment on oneself, torturing oneself. Those are it's a very, say, very useful skill, and I think the quality of loving kindness, of course, is one of this is one of the it's called a Brahma Vihara, or a divine abiding. But that sort of puts it sort of out there somewhere. I mean, divine, that's way off somewhere else. One of the monks in England started using and translating it as this mature emotion. And that's a really skillful way of bringing attention to that. Now, this is a really mature emotion, to be able to turn attention to loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. Certainly the doorway into them all. Is this quality of loving kindness, and by bringing attention to that consciously, and then also bringing attention to, well, how does that? What obstructs it? Where do we? What are the things that? Because we can start to pay attention to the. Say the immature emotions, those are fairly accessible, and recognizing the there's that twinge of jealousy, there's that twinge of that sense of moving toward comparing, there's that irritation, and so rather than letting them start to gain momentum. Say, how can I bring a mature emotion into this? How can I bring this some space around this? That quality of loving kindness is one that creates space. It's a very spacious emotion. And as we create that spaciousness, it's also very solid. It's not whether it's sort of fleeting kind of pleasure, delight, gratification, or irritation, jealousy, aversion, those come up in the mind, but they don't create a steadiness. They're not a very stable feeling, emotion to be in the heart. Whereas that quality of loving kindness is one, as we tune into it and tap into it and direct attention to it, one realizes, well, there's a stability and a groundedness that comes from that. It's very one has a ground underneath oneself that is not shaken by sort of the vagaries of either the internal world of our emotions and reactions or the external world of change and praise and blame. I think of those people that I've met who embodied loving kindness. There's also a tremendous steadiness or stability there. So that one of the again, thinking of something being billed as a metta retreat. What do we do? We come and sort of ooze sort of niceness. Wouldn't that be great? Just ooze niceness. That kind of turns my stomach actually. But the kind of effort that one puts in trying to sort of beam all this love everywhere. It can get pretty tiring. But I think of that again with that sense of those people who I've met who really. If once I felt really embodied loving kindness and tremendous stability. I think of one particular circumstance in my life that was very, very one that was very, very helpful for me, and it was very illuminating as well. I'd been the abbot of International Forest Monastery in Thailand for a few years, not that long, and I was. I was finding it overwhelming, and I had a chance to go to England, and Ajahn Sumedho was there, and many of the other senior Western monks were there, sort of old mates, and I was still stuck in Thailand, looking after a monastery that I wasn't sure whether I'm capable of even doing it, or even I wanted to do it. And then conflict with the monks' duties with the lay community, and sort of feeling overwhelmed, and then getting toward the end of the my stay in England, which was just a few weeks, and then I was like, I was just dreading getting on the plane. And I was it was a miserable plane ride, just because it was, oh God, I've got to go back to the monastery. It's this monk and that monk. And one of the things that one of the senior monks in England who'd lived in Thailand for many years, he had a little package. He said, when you get to Bangkok, please take this and offer it to this particular monk who had a good reputation. It was actually proper Yuto. But I hadn't met him yet. And he was also not so well known at that time. I mean, now he's sort of internationally renowned. And in those days, he lived in a temple in Bangkok, in the old, on the edge of Chinatown and the old central part of the city. I can't remember the name of the temple, but it's and the area that he was in wasn't particularly nice area. It was sort of, oftentimes in Bangkok, what you've got is areas where a particular part of the city, say like all of the monk shops are in one area. There's got streets of that, or there's another area where it's the cloth section, well, this area that this temple was at was the place where the, it looked like they fixed transmissions or something. It was, you walked in, there was sort of oil and grease and car parts everywhere. And you walked into the temple, and the temple was one of the things it did. Also, was it did cremations for the very poorest of the poor people. And so that it, so it was always something happening, and it was crowded. And I went to the back where his dwelling place was, and he was the abbot of that monastery, or assistant abbot, I can't remember now. And he just radiated peace and kindness in the center of this busyness, dirtiness, kind of pollution, chaos, and he just was this anchor of peace and clarity and kindness, and it was really. And then talking to him, he was extraordinarily kind and received me very well. He's very, very well known, respected in Thailand, and people come from all levels of society to pay respects to him. He was one of the very few monks in Thailand to complete all of his studies of the scriptures in Pali when he's still a novice. And when that happens, then the king is the sponsor for his ordination. So it's a tradition. And so he's a brilliant mind, but it's just his... because sometimes somebody with a really brilliant mind is not necessarily attuned to other people. But he had this real completeness. And it was just, everything was suffused with kindness. And it really struck me how that's a way that I can survive. if I could turn my attention to those qualities of kindness metta, that that'll hold me in good stead. And also that, you know, if, I mean, I'm going back to a quiet forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand, and there, and he, if I can't get some peace out of that, then I'm doing something wrong with my holy life. it was a wonderful example, and similar, some of the people who are here were met him, and when I took a group to Thailand, and you know, he received us so graciously, and he's in constant pain. His health is not good. He's always been plagued by ill health, he's in constant pain. But the quality of kindness that radiates from him just goes across the board. You see that again, the sense of some mature emotion that is very steadying, very stabilizing, very grounding. These are not qualities that people are every once in a while they're born with it, and you know they get it all, and nobody else can cultivate it and do anything about it. These are universal qualities that anybody can cultivate, can tap into. So that this is a, you know, I think it's an important reflection in the sense, oh, this is a mature emotion to direct attention to. And it gives us the opportunity to say whether one's in a family situation, whether one's in a social situation, whether it's with Buddhists, with ordinary people in society, or dealing with oneself. These are the important quality to be able to direct attention to.